What we're now going to do is start off doing a little bit of dimensional analysis that's going to have a shockingly important ramifications. Now, in fact, I'm going to just, we'll do the dimensional analysis. We'll draw the very naive, obvious-seeming result of this general dimensional analysis. And then that skips over 40 years of massive confusion in the field from the late 30s to the late 60s, where the basic lesson of this simple dimensional analysis was completely confused and not understood correctly. Okay? And of course, that's not because people were idiots. It's because when you do this naive dimensional analysis, you'll see what its consequences are. But then when you actually start doing computations in quantum field theory, people find all these infinities and divergences and renormalization and all these issues come up, and it sort of clouded everything. And it turned out to be all a complete red herring. This naive dimensional analysis is perfectly correct. I'll tell you the correct way of talking about it. I'll leave it for your course, and I hope whoever teaches you field theory will teach you this Wilsonian way of thinking about what's called effective field theories, the renormalization group, all of these ideas. So there was something deep underneath it that legitimizes this naive dimensional analysis. But it's one of these cases where if you're very naive, you actually happen to get the right answer, and then understanding why there is something deep underneath it. But for the purposes of, and this is one of the most important things that's happened in physics in the last 50 years, is understanding this deep way of thinking about quantum field theory. But I could tell you all the words now, but you really won't appreciate it until you suffer through some standard bad way of talking about it. So it's actually worth suffering through it so that when the Wilsonian way is revealed to you, it's like a message from above, you know. Anyway, so it's a little bit of dimensional analysis I want to do is to talk about what the units of these fields that we just talked about are. Okay. So, what are the units? Well, remember we wrote down something that looked like. If we wanted to go back and write let me think about the easiest way of doing this. The easiest way of talking about this is if I told you about the Lagrangian way of talking about this thing to begin with, but since I didn't, I'll have to suffer slightly more. Actually, let's just do it. So the free interaction that we wrote down was like d cubed p over 2 pi cubed 2 ep. Right? And then we said it's like EP, AP dagger, AP. So from here, we can read off what the units of, like A are. Okay? So this is supposed to have units of energy. It says units of energy. So this thing has units of energy squared, energy cubed. So the units of AP dagger AP should be one over energy cubed. I don't want that answer. Let me say. So I want. So this is what we define. Let's say for 5 plus, right? So let's see, what is it? So, I'm sorry. Right. No. Right. That's right. Right. Yeah. This is right. So this is what, with the definitions that we had before, this is what the actual Hamiltonian would be. And this is what phi plus would be. The units of A are now from here, this is energy cubed, energy to the fourth. So the units of A should be energy to the minus 2. So the units of phi plus are 1. So phi plus has mass dimension 1. Now, before we go on, I forgot. There are two things from earlier I want to correct. First, I think I may have said phi plus of x prime don't commute outside the light cone. These, of course, do commute. They're just a's and a's, or a daggers and a daggers commute. I meant phi plus of x dagger, or phi minus of x prime doesn't commute outside the light cone. Okay. So that was one. And secondly, these somewhere in the middle, towards the end, when we'd switch interaction representation all the time, I started dropping the I's on all the phi's. So, well, you should probably drop them all, but because it's a pain to carry them around since you're always in the interaction representation. But then remember that, and don't get confused later. Okay? Yes. Oh, because with the definition that we had put in for what the normalization was before, this is what the Hamiltonian actually is. Okay, it's so. Yeah. So with this, yeah. So if you like, yeah. Yeah. Whatever definition, the real point is whatever definition we had for what this D3 slash was here, the same definition goes into making A e to the minus IPX. Okay. So I can move from this normalization to another normalization, I just have to consistently use the same measure in both places. So with the normalization that I was telling you about before, this is what the Hamiltonian actually is. But actually, just to make it a little less mysterious. If we had written a classical field theory to begin with, okay, then a nice way of characterizing in a Lorentz invariant way what that classical field theory is would have been to give its Lagrangian, and its Lagrangian, its action, which would be the integral dt of some Lagrangian, and the Lagrangian itself would be an integral over space of a Lagrangian density. So this again would be a nice d4x of a Lagrangian density. Now, if we have a scalar theory, then the simplest Lagrangian that we can have would involve a derivative on phi and a derivative on phi. Just a d mu phi, d mu phi. This would be a nice massless scalar field. Okay. And so you can see from here, and if it has a mass, then you could write down a term without any derivative, just with an m squared and two phis. So this looks like kinetic energy minus potential energy, right? So this is the kinetic term, but we're writing in a Lorentz invariant way. So it's a d phi d phi. Okay? And so from here now, and this phi is the same phi as we were talking about. So this is a classical field, but if you went, you validated to the operator, if you went through the backwards language, which is what I was avoiding, okay, this thing would turn into an operator and would satisfy all the properties that we talked about. Okay? But this way of talking about it makes it very immediate to see what its units are. So it has to have units. The action is dimensionless. Action is units of h bar, which is 1. Okay, so action is dimensionless. So d phi has to have units of mass to the fourth. A derivative has units of 1 over length or mass. So these two derivatives have units mass squared, just like that mass squared also has units mass squared. And so phi has mass dimension 1. Now, this is actually a nice, so maybe that doesn't mean much, but it actually has a very cool immediate consequence. Actually, we could do this in any number of dimensions. So if we did this, if we imagined now writing this thing in d dimensions, we'd write a half d phi squared and an m squared phi squared. And we could work out what the dimensions of phi are in any number of dimensions. And the dimensions of phi, the mass dimension of phi, is d minus 2 divided by 2. Okay? In any number of dimensions. I'm just writing this down so that you see something interesting happens when d equals 2. Okay? At d equals 2, this becomes dimensionless. If d equals 1, d equals 1 from this point of view is just a time integral, right? And then this action just becomes that of a normal particle, like in quantum mechanics. It just becomes ordinary quantum mechanics, not even field theory. Okay? So something funny happens. There's a big crossover in behavior between just ordinary quantum mechanics and d bigger than 2. Okay? So this dimension is flipping sign, and it flips sign around d equals 2. I'm just about to tell you a nice physical interpretation for what this dimension is, which is going to make this, which is going to help you understand what the physics is of that mass dimension. And to do that, we're going to talk about something. But for some reason, even many field theory books don't spend a lot of time talking about the kind of Schrödinger picture for what field theory looks like. You know, the actual wave function. You spend a lot of time talking about scattering particles and things like that, which is great. But you can also talk about, you know, all the standard stuff you do in quantum mechanics, you can also do. It's just quantum mechanics, after all. Okay. So an interesting question is to ask for the ground state wave function, just of the free theory. Let's just talk about the ground state wave function of a free theory. Okay? Now, the ground state wave function of a harmonic oscillator is e to the negative omega x squared. If the frequency is omega, it's e to the negative omega x squared. So field theory, the Hamiltonian, this is just what we're saying, is like d cubed p ep. So let's say the energy of this particle, let's say it's massless. Okay? So its energy of this particle is e. And then we have ap dagger ap, which in this language has just turned into phi p mod squared. Okay? So that's the frequency and the, sorry. So that's the analog of the frequency, and the analog of x is just phi itself. So, and I have, well, let me say this again. So I have, for each momentum mode, I have some harmonic oscillator. The frequency of that harmonic oscillator is the energy, which if the particle is massless, is just the magnitude of p. And the analog of x is phi. And this product over p of a bunch of exponentials, I can just loosely write as an integral, the product of a bunch of exponentials is the exponential of the sum. The sum means product. So it's d cubed p, p, 5p squared. So that's actually what you would call the wave function of the ground state. Now, what is this a function of? If you give me some phi of x, so phi is an operator. Phi of x is an operator, right? So it has eigenstates, which are just labeled by some little phi. Okay, so phi of x is an operator. So if you hand me any old function, phi of x, there's a wave function associated with that configuration of phi. Okay? Yeah? 5p is the Fourier transform of phi. That's right. 5p is just the Fourier transform of phi of x. So phi twiddle p. Phi twiddle p. Because there's a separate harmonic oscillator for each one of those modes. All right, so this is nice because it gives us some feeling. So let's say I have this scalar field, and I want to know what are the chances that just in the ground state, if I measured the value of that scalar field, it would have a certain kind of profile. Okay, so let's ask. I get that chance just by evaluating the wave function and mod squaring. Okay? So let's ask for a profile that's just some smooth shape that looks like this. Okay? In other words, I want to imagine, so let me draw it another way. I want to imagine that phi is mostly zero, but that in some region of space of size R, it has a value phi naught. Okay? And then outside, it's zero. And it's all happening very smoothly. Then the wave function in this configuration of the ground state is what? Well, it's e to the negative phi naught squared. It's Gaussian, so it's certainly proportional to phi naught squared. And of course, you could go through this whole song and dance and say you transform, blah. Well, we can even do it. But since there's only one length scale in the problem, and we just saw that phi naught has mass dimension 1, the only thing that could occur here is r squared. Okay? So that gives you a nice feeling that in the ground state, phi has some fluctuations. If you were to see what are the chances that if you look at phi in some region of size r, how big are the fluctuations in r? How big are the fluctuations in phi? The typical size of the fluctuations in phi of order 1 over r. Okay. So delta phi typically is of order 1 over r. That's really interesting because it means that as you make this ball bigger and bigger, phi isn't fluctuating. Okay. So there is a meaningful quantity, if you like, the average value of phi over all of space is a nice, meaningful quantity. It doesn't have big quantum fluctuations. Okay? That's actually very different than what you... So if we go back to just thinking about this... if we go back to thinking about this free action, when I wrote ddx, and here I'm just talking about even massless particles, so we had d mu phi, d mu phi. And if d equals 1, this would just be dt a half phi dot squared, right? If d equals 2, if d is bigger than 1 in general, it's integral dt a half phi dot squared minus a half grad phi squared in general, okay? For d bigger than 1. But for d equals 1, what we're calling phi is just like position. I mean, this is just what you call the kinetic energy for a particle in ordinary quantum mechanics, the half mv squared. We're setting m equal to 1. But it's just like standard quantum mechanics. So phi is like the position in standard quantum mechanics when d is equal to 1. But you know that in the ground state for just a single particle moving along, the ground state of this particle in a box has a wave function that's completely delocalized in the box, right? So the position of the particle is a completely delocalized quantity in the ground state. is not a well-defined quantity at all, right? The uncertainty in the position is infinite. In fact, as you make the box bigger and bigger, the uncertainty gets just tracks the size of the box. Okay? But what I'm telling you is that when d is 4, in fact, if d is bigger than 2, the analog of phi becomes very well-defined as the box gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Okay? It has very small fluctuations. So what's going on here? What's going on here is this gradient term. Okay? So that's like a potential energy term. If you wanted to think about this, you could think that at every separate point in space, there is a separate ordinary quantum mechanical particle. Okay? Imagine just discretizing space for a second. There's a very fine lattice, and on each lattice point, you have a separate quantum mechanical particle. If this gradient term didn't exist at all, I would just have separate quantum mechanical particles on each site, and their wave function would be totally delocalized. In the ground state, it would be completely, totally delocalized. But this gradient term is like a potential energy that forces there to be correlations between neighboring sites with each other. Okay? And that causes there to be a cost for having neighboring things be very different than each other. Okay? What happens as you go up in dimensions is that cost starts winning. Okay? At d equals 2, it's just marginal. Okay? At d equals 2, these two things are just compensating each other. The fact that this scalar field has mass dimension 2 in two dimensions is a reflection of the fact that in two dimensions, these fluctuations are in fact, logarithmic. Okay? So they're the same on all scales, not particularly big on short or small scales. That's something that makes two-dimensional field theories very interesting. Okay? It's one of the reasons two-dimensional field theories are amazingly interesting and rich. But when you go above two dimensions, these fluctuations go the other way. Each point is surrounded by so many other points that are making it cost something when there's big spatial fluctuations, that the spatial fluctuations are just damped out. Okay? So the fluctuations in phi get smaller and smaller as you go to longer and longer distances. But that gives you a good physical picture for what to mean by this mass dimension, right? This mass dimension of phi is a measure of how big its quantum fluctuations are. And it's telling you that its fluctuations get smaller and smaller as you go to larger and larger distances. And conversely, bigger and bigger as you go to shorter and shorter distances. Okay. So now let's go back and write down what our interaction Hamiltonians could look like. Well, I've written down a Lagrangian already. I could also write them down in a Lagrangian. It doesn't make much difference. One way or another, we're writing things down that look like d4x. Okay. So let's talk about the one that we just talked about before, the phi to the fourth of x. That was a nice one. What are the units of this interaction strength? There would be a coupling in front of it. What are the units of that coupling? Phi has mass dimension 1. So phi to the fourth has mass dimension 4. So d4x has mass dimension negative 4. This whole thing should be dimensionless. So lambda is dimensionless. Had I written down something like phi cubed, this coefficient would have mass dimension 1. Okay. But you see, the vast majority of other interactions that you might imagine writing down. So let's say, what about phi to the sixth? Okay. What are the coefficients, what are the units of this interaction? The units would have units of 1 over mass squared. Okay? So 1 over some m squared. We'd have 1 over m to the 4th phi to the 8th. There's all sorts of things I could write down. I could have written down phi squared with some derivative on phi, some derivative on phi. Okay, what this would also be, something that goes like m squared plus so on. Okay? It's clear there's zillions of things I could write down. But the vast majority of interactions, just because of this basic dimensional analysis fact that phi has mass dimension 1, the vast majority of interactions have a strength which is an inverse power of mass. And only a few interactions are dimensionless or have positive mass dimension. Okay? So there's clearly a physical difference between these kinds of interactions, and they have names. The ones which are dimensionless and positive dimension are, as we'll see in a second, the important ones. They're called marginal and relevant. Okay, those are their technical names, marginal interactions and relevant interactions. The marginal ones are the most interesting ones, okay? Relevant ones we don't like so much, even though they're relevant. But all the other ones, negative dimension, are called irrelevant. They're irrelevant interactions. Now, why do we use this terminology? Well, it's just this basic dimensional analysis reason that we've talked about already in the context of gravity, right? Gravity is a nice example of an interaction which is irrelevant. The strength of this interaction is the inverse of some mass scale. That means that either the interaction, in no invariant sense is it strong or weak. Okay? At energies low compared to that mass scale, it's very weak and basically unimportant. At energies comparable or above that mass scale, it becomes very important, but becomes so important that we need to completely change the theory and use some new theory, because these interactions are becoming completely order one in strength. We have no idea what we're doing anymore, and we need to replace the theory with something else. If you have a theory like this, then it always comes equipped, in principle, with some scale m at which it breaks down. You don't know what's going on up there. Okay? But at low energies compared to that scale, whatever it is, you don't need to keep track of hundreds, infinite number of parameters. There's only a few parameters that can possibly matter. Down here, only marginal and relevant couplings matter. This is a very powerful way of thinking about things, because in any situation, you can ask, in any given situation, it means if you want to describe physics at some fixed energy scale, in the neighborhood of some fixed energy scale, all you need to know is what are the particles around, there are some fields associated with those particles, and all you then need to know is just classify every possible marginal or relevant interaction that you can write down between them. You just write them all down, okay? You just write, I mean, here we did in this one example with a few fields, but you just write them all down. There's a fixed number of parameters, and that's it. Whatever's going on at around those energy scales can be accurately described just keeping those parameters and nothing else. If you want to predict things to much higher accuracy, if you want to predict things, let's say you're down at energies E, and the scale M is, I don't know, 100 times above where you are. If you want to predict things to accuracy E over M squared, then maybe you have to include these next terms. If you really want to be that damn accurate, which you rarely do. If you want to be more and more accurate, you have to include more and more of those terms. But the dominant interactions at low enough energies are always characterized by a fixed small number of relevant particles and the marginal and relevant interactions between them. The reason the marginal ones are the most interesting is that the relevant ones, conversely, are only important at very low energies. Okay? So we always like to think about some approximation especially since we're doing, if you're interested in relativistic physics, you're always doing some approximation where the particles are moving very fast compared to their masses. The energies are high. In some approximation, you want to ignore all the masses and scatter particles at very, very high energies and see what comes out. So in that sort of approximation, the only kinds of things that matter are the marginal interactions. Okay? Because you're neither at energies that are so high that you need to know what all the irrelevant couplings are, nor are you at energies so low, because typically these relevant interactions are setting low energy mass scales, masses of particles and so on. And we're typically interested in being situations where we don't care about them either. Okay? So, of course, the relevant ones do ultimately become important at very, very low energies. But the most interesting ones are the marginal interactions. In the approximation where you neglect the masses of the particles, you are only talking about these marginal interactions. Now, in every situation, everywhere in physics, there is some actual scale, physical scale M. Sometimes this is called the ultraviolet cutoff scale. But it's a physical thing. There's some physical scale at which whatever your description of the physics is wrong. Okay? For instance, no matter what we do, there is some scale beyond which we know for sure this whole picture is wrong, which is when M is M Planck. Okay? So that's just a fact about nature. Any effective field theory that we talk about, any field theory is whatever particles we see, we group them into fields, we talk about their interactions, anything we do is inevitably an effective theory because we don't know what's going on at the Planck scale. So that means that every single theory, everything we ever talk about, we should be thinking that there's a whole ton of irrelevant interactions, perhaps suppressed by the powers of the Planck scale, which encode all the information about what's going on actually at the Planck scale. Okay? But if we're at energies much lower than the Planck scale, we don't care. Or if we care, only to the extent that we care about these very, very tiny effects. So it would be of order e squared over m Planck squared. Okay? In practice, we don't know things way before the Planck scale. We don't know what's coming next at the LHC. Okay? Maybe it's just another field theory. It's very likely another field theory because there's no reason for these basic laws of relativity and quantum mechanics to be breaking down, except perhaps at the Planck scale. So it's some other field theory. Even if it's some other field theory, whatever it is, at low enough energies, I don't see those particles. We haven't seen them yet. We don't know what they are. So how do we manage to do physics in ignorance of knowing the next fundamental layer of description? Well, whatever the heck it is encoded in a bunch of irrelevant operators, irrelevant interactions, okay, that are telling us what's going on now at the 1 TeV scale. We haven't been there yet. We're just about to go. But there's also irrelevant operators there. Once we figure out what's going on at that scale, then let's say we go up to 10 TeV. Then we know what's going on at the TeV scale. We would have seen a bunch of extra particles. And we could then, had we done very accurate measurements to deduce the presence of these irrelevant operators, we would have understood where they came from. Okay? Because we'd have gone to higher energies and seen what the physics was that gave rise to them. But at any given energy scale, the way to organize your thinking about physics is scale by scale. At any given energy scale, you see what are the particles out there, group them into fields, write down all the interactions you can, stare at the marginal ones first, they're the most important ones, and that's it. It's a machine. Okay? It really removes any... all of thinking goes into talking about the kinds of interactions that are allowed, the specific ones that are there, and trying to understand them better. But right away, this explains why there's guaranteed to be a finite number of parameters at any given energy scale to describe the physics that's going on accurately. Okay? But every single theory we ever write down is an effective theory and is never going to get things perfectly accurately by amounts of order powers of the low energy scale that we're at divided by the high energy scale at which something new happens. And minimally, and even if we understand everything perfectly at the LHC, in 30 years we know what's going on at 10 TeV, 100 TeV, okay, there's something always of order E over M Planck to powers that we don't know. Okay? But as I said, there's a whole tower of effective theories, one after the other, after the other, after the other, each physically being accompanied with its own ultraviolet cutoff, and as you keep going, you find a new one, and so on. But it's so as I say, I'm summarizing 40 years of confusion. This whole picture of this basic dimensional analysis becomes confused by the presence of ultraviolet divergences in field theory, but in fact, it's not confusing if you think about it the way Wilson did, and you will be taught that. Okay, but this is the bottom line. What I want you to gather from here is already there's a massive restriction, massive restriction. Not only is there antiparticles and spin statistics, but even the kinds of interactions we're allowed to have that are going to be relevant at any reasonable energy scale are incredibly restricted. Think again how incredibly different this is than non-relative physics quantum mechanics. I can write down any crappy potential that I want between particles. 1/r, 1/r^2.3, random linear combinations of x squared and x to the fourth and x to the sixth or the harmonic oscillator. Non-relativistic physics is tremendously unconstrained. The framework itself is tremendously unconstrained. The second we put in relativity and quantum mechanics, boom, all these incredibly, these very dramatic kinematic things happen, spin statistics, antiparticles, and on top of that, the number of interactions that we're talking about is now down to numbers that you can count on your hand. Okay? So in the standard model of interactions that we have, there is like 19 of these relevant, of these marginal interactions. Okay? Okay, it's not one, but it's not continuous infinity either. And continuous infinity is what you get in any non-relativistic picture of the world. Okay? All right, but now I want to tell you a little bit more, even. So once again, I want to always work in an approximation where I'm neglecting the masses of all particles, because I'm imagining that we're thinking about sort of very high energy processes relative to the masses of particles. Okay? This I have not explained, and it's not very important, but let me actually just write it down so you see. We just talked about what the sort of free theory would look like for scalars. It turns out that for fermions, if you want to talk about it in the same language, you would write down something schematically of this form. Okay? And again, this really comes out of the whole discussion we were just having. You put the A daggers or fermions, you build them in a field, et cetera, et cetera. If you just follow it, all of this comes out. I just haven't had time to do it. But again, if you talk about it the other way around, starting from a field and quantizing and all that stuff, you would start with something that looks like that. That's the Dirac field. And normally, if you look at these things, there's gamma matrices and so on, but I'm not writing any of that down. I'm just stressing here that it's got one derivative here and not two derivatives. So the mass dimension of bosons is 1, the mass dimension of fermions is 3/2. Okay. 3/2 plus 3/2 is 3. The mass dimension of derivative is 1/length, so it's mass is 4, that whole thing is mass dimension 4, which is right, to compensate against the d4x and become dimensionless. All right, so I'm just writing it down so we can write down once and for all every possible interaction that we can have in 4 dimensions, which are marginal. I can have things that look like 4 bosons. I can have things that look like 3 bosons and a derivative in a boson. Now, if this is really a scalar field, then I can't do this in a Lorentz invariant way, because that derivative has a d mu index on it. But when I say boson, I'm imagining this could be something that also has its own Lorentz indices. We'll talk about the photon field in a second. Okay, so don't get too exercised about indices here. We're just doing dimension counting. I can have interactions like this. I can have interactions that look like that. I can have interactions that look like 2 fermions in a boson. Oh, sorry, what am I doing? Phi squared d phi, sorry. And that's it. Those are the only dimensionless interactions that you can build with these objects. You can write down mass terms. You can write down mass terms like m phi squared or m psi psi. m squared, phi squared, or m psi psi, right? So psi psi is unit 3, so its coefficient would have to be m. You can write things down like phi cubed, maybe. Okay? But ignoring the relevant interactions, the only marginal interactions are of this schematic form. Okay? That's really remarkable. That's telling us the basic interactions in nature are of the form fermion, fermion, boson. Boson, 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 or boson, boson, boson. Okay? Every interaction we have in nature at sufficiently low energies compared to the Planck energy. Just the rules of relativity and quantum mechanics tell us that we need to have a theory that consists of some fermions and some bosons, and the only possible interactions that would be relevant at, well, marginal, but would be important to studying physics at energies low compared to the Planck scale, whatever the heck is going on above the Planck scale, who cares at the moment, is just built out of these three basic types. Okay, so first of all, no matter what, just dimension counting tells us that there's very, very few possible interactions. So now I'm going to go through the last bit of logic for telling you why the world is such a damn constrained place. And tell you that furthermore, the spins of the particles are bounded. In other words, I can't have any marginal interactions between particles that have spin bigger than one, even. If I just really want to insist on having marginal interactions, the only things that can possibly have are spin 0, spin 1/2, and spin 1. Above that, they can't have any marginal interactions at all. It's actually worse than that. If I want them to have any interesting long-distance manifestations at all, it's bounded by spin 2. So there's a good reason why we haven't seen set spin 17 massless particles lying around. Okay? And something actually dramatic happens the second you start talking about massless particles when the spin hits 1. Starting at spin 1, something very new happens. Well, new in the sense that the rules that we just talked about are still not enough to guarantee that the result is Lorentz invariant. Okay? And you'll see why in a second. And in fact, to make sure that you're talking about the interactions of massless spin 1 particles in a way which is manifestly Lorentz invariant, unitary, all the rules, the kind of theory you have is dead nailed. No choice in it whatsoever. It must be a Yang-Mills theory for spin 1. And for spin 2, it must be at low enough energies, it must be general relativity. Of course, we can have irrelevant operators which correct all of these things, but the leading interactions are those of Yang-Mills, standard Yang-Mills theory, and general relativity. There's no choice. It has nothing to do, as I've said many times, nothing to do with aesthetics or it's pretty, nature loves beauty. Absolutely not. Okay, it's rigid. And this is very important to appreciate that nature isn't. The beauty of the laws of nature isn't the flowery beauty of the Pre-Raphaelites. It's a very austere kind of rigid beauty. There are some wonderful Canadian artists. A group of Canadian artists known as the Group of Seven. And whenever I think about the beauty of the laws of nature, I'm reminded of Group of Seven paintings. It's very austere, and the beauty is in their rigidity, not in the loveliness of the math or anything like that. Okay, so it's and you get a much deeper sense that something is the way it is just because it cannot possibly be any other way. That's just really remarkable. So, amongst other things, we'll see in a second, the equivalence principle is, had Einstein never existed, I mean, it would have taken 50 years. But in 50 years, quantum field theorists plodding along, no problem, would have discovered the principle of equivalence, they would have discovered GR, they would have discovered the whole shebang. Because while in a classical world, it took all these leaps of imagination, the quantum world is so constrained that it's just forced on you. And you can't do it any other way. Okay, so let's talk about why it is that massless spin 1 particles already cause so much trouble. The reason has to do with this basic fact that the massless spin 1 particles have only helicity. See, there's no difference in degrees of freedom between a massless spin 1 particle and a massive spin 1 particle. They both have 1 degree of freedom. But there is a strange discontinuous difference between the number of degrees of freedom of a massless and a massive spin 1 particle. The massless spin 1 particle has 2 degrees of freedom, the massive has 3. Okay? All right, so let's ask how we would have to. That's the root of all the difficulties. Is we have to figure out how to describe those. We have to figure out how to do that. So it's clear that if you want to describe massless spin 1 particles, we want to build fields that will look like they have a vector index, a mu. Okay. So again, if we were actually getting this from quantizing Maxwell's equations, we'd start with the vector potential. We'd start with a mu of x. But even from our point of view, we're trying to put together, there's a massless spin 1 particle. We want to build a field out of it that's going to transform nicely under Lorentz transformations. That field should clearly have a mu index because it has to know the particle has spin 1 somehow, right? So what I want to do is build an a mu of x, which is an integral of d3p. Now, I have an AP for the plus helicity photon, e to the ipx. All right? And I have an AP for a minus helicity photon. All right, but I have to get something over here that looks like it has a mu index. So what we do, and what you see in books, is you just say, there's a polarization vector, epsilon mu plus of p. Okay? And you say there's a polarization vector, epsilon mu minus of p. That's just the from you're familiar with an E&M, right? You write a solution of the, if you were to write a free solution of Maxwell's equations, you would say a mu of x is e to the ipx times some polarization vector, epsilon mu of p. Just tells you what the polarization of the light wave is. So we add plus Hermitian conjugate here. Okay. So far, so good. But now we encounter something new here. A number of new things which are related to each other. They're all related to each other. So let's depending on how you want to talk about things. You choose different aspects of it as being the sort of crucial problem, but they're all related. So one problem here is that physically, how many degrees of freedom are there in the photon? We just said 2. But how many amus are there? There's 4 amus. A0, 1, 2, 3. So if I go ahead and build some kind of Hamiltonian density made out of the amus, I can do it. I can write some nice things down, make it Lorentz invariant, everything is fine. But if I do it, somehow propagating in here are 4 degrees of freedom, which are more than the 2 that are actually there. That's funny, okay? Well, I could try to make fewer degrees of freedom. If I think about these polarization vectors, another way of saying it is that, you know, I could try to say that these polarization vectors are not random, right? They satisfy some constraint. I can try to constrain these polarization vectors. So a constraint I can put on them, what's the only possible Lorentz invariant constraint I can put on them? It's that p mu epsilon mu equals 0. Right? That's all I can do. So that's a constraint that I can put on the polarization vectors. That removes 1 degree of freedom. Right? So now I have sort of 3 different epsilons. Actually, if I was trying to describe a massive spin 1 particle, I would still have this problem, the problem that I alluded to, right? A mu would have 4 degrees of freedom, naively, but there's only 3 for the massive spin 1 particle. And that's nicely solved by forcing these polarization vectors to have p mu epsilon mu equals 0. Okay? Let's just think intuitively why that is. Imagine we go to rest, to a frame where p mu is rest, is at rest. This just says that epsilon mu in that frame would be zero and just any old three vector epsilon. That's fine. That's exactly what it should be, right? The degrees of freedom are just the a three vector associated with the spin of this massive spin one particle in its rest frame. But for a massless particle, I can't do that. For a massless particle, I cannot do that. For a massless particle, there's still one too many degrees of freedom. Right? Still one too many degrees of freedom. So the only choice I have, the only thing I can do, I have to describe things this way, but I have to make sure that whatever I do, if I calculate some, if I compute any process I like, it had better be that that if I have the polarization epsilon mu of p, the problem is that if I have epsilon mu of p, and I have epsilon mu of p plus anything times p mu, both of these things are satisfy this equation, because p squared equals zero. Okay? So there's some ambiguity in what you can mean by the polarization vector. You can always add to it something proportional to p mu. Okay? And it'll continue to satisfy this equation. So there's just, this can only knock down the degrees of freedom in the polarization vector from 4 to 3, but it can't knock you down from 3 to 2. And the problem is, any way that you come up with to say, oh no, I just mean two polarization vectors, then someone else will say, no, I want to choose these ones. Okay? They'll satisfy exactly the same equations. For instance, if a particle is moving in the direction, in the z direction, then you might talk about positive and negative helicity polarization vectors. You may have seen it in E&M courses, is something that would look like this. Okay? And that's fine, but nothing stops me from adding anything proportional to 1001 to it. Okay? Now, another way of saying this problem is that another way of phrasing this problem is that, let's say you choose in some Lorentz frame some set of polarization vectors. Okay? Let's say you just decide, like in that, let's just say in the frame where the particle is moving in the z direction, I just declare, here are the two polarization vectors. They're equal to 0, 1 over root 2, plus or minus 1 over root 2, 0. That's my declaration, and then I'm going to so there's only two of them. That's what they are. That's fine. If you make this definition for what the polarization vectors are, you're free to do that. But then under Lorentz transformations, this polarization vector does not simply transform into itself. Okay? It'll transform into itself up to something proportional to p mu. It's just a basic problem. There's no Lorentz invariant way of picking out two guys. Okay? There just isn't. And if you stick in one frame and say, these are the guys that I'm talking about, screw you, I don't care, these are my polarization vectors, that's perfectly fine. Now the problem is that your polarization vectors are not actually Lorentz 4 vectors. Under Lorentz transformations, they'll Lorentz transform into themselves plus something proportional to p mu. Now, what one does, so this is going to have to be a little schematic, but what one normally does after we define these fields is we go and we start talking about what the interactions look like. We drew some of the stick figures for what the interactions look like, but you turn these stick figures into these Feynman diagrams. So if I'm, so you don't need, at the moment we don't need to know anything in detail about what this is. But what you do is you compute the interactions between A mu, A nu, let's say this is an electron coming in somehow, Okay, so you compute all of these just from your just from that formula, from the time ordered e to the minus form, from that perturbation theory formula. You just compute all sorts of things. The things that you compute are not the actual amplitudes for the particles. They're associated with these external fields, with these a mu, a nu, and everything. So they would have this index, mu, nu, other things that would depend on the momentum of the first photon, the second photon, other things. Let's call this p mu, p nu. And then to get the physical amplitude, you say, it's dotted into the polarization vector. So to tell it that it's polarization H1 and H2, I would dot into the corresponding polarization vectors. So that's what comes out of the, that's just what comes out of the machinery in a totally straightforward way. And it fools you into thinking that everything is hunky-dory and Lorentz invariant. But it would be if those polarization vectors were transformed like four vectors, but they don't, just for the reason I said. Okay? So either way you say it, you have a problem that you have to make sure that if you compute an actual physical amplitude in the end, which is what you get by dotting into these polarization vectors, you have to ensure, which is not obvious, you have to ensure that you get the same answer is obtained if you use epsilon mu or epsilon mu plus anything times p mu. It had better be that it doesn't actually matter which one of these guys you use. That's the only way the answer will be Lorentz invariant. Okay? If you choose in one frame some set of epsilon, someone else does a Lorentz transformation, their epsilons are going to be off by yours, not just a Lorentz transformation, by something proportional to p mu. The only way you can get the same answers is if it actually didn't matter. Okay? So you see, we are baking into our description of the physics now a redundancy. We're saying that we can describe the scattering of these particles using polarization vectors and field theory. Okay, we compute things with field theory, we dot into polarization vectors, but we've got to make sure that this description is redundant. Two different epsilons should be correspond to exactly the same physical state. Epsilon mu and epsilon mu plus anything proportional to p mu should be taken to be the same state. Okay, epsilon mu and epsilon mu plus anything times p mu should describe the same state. The answers should be the same. And yet, in order to ensure the locality of the interactions, we built things out of fields and all of this stuff in a way that clearly has some redundant information in it. Right? There's all these extra, there's four fields running around. There's four fields running around in the Lagrangian and these interactions, everything. Okay? All of that redundancy came in because we were trying to describe this physics in a local way, right? We grouped them into fields. We did all of this stuff because of our desire to describe the interactions in a local way. But it's coming at a cost. We had better make sure that there's a lot of redundancy. We had better make sure that that in the final answer, if I choose epsilon or epsilon plus anything proportional to p mu, that we get the same answer. This ends up being an amazingly strong constraint. And it tells you that the sort of interactions that you can write down, that's the result I was telling you. There have to be Yang-Mills theory for spin 1 particles and GR for spin 2 particles. To ensure that, and the statement here, by the way, in GR, for spin 2 particles, sorry, I should say, I would have some polarization vector, epsilon mu nu. It would have to be spin 2. So it's a polarization to epsilon mu nu, and I'd have to make sure that there's a redundancy under epsilon mu nu goes to epsilon something alpha nu p mu plus alpha mu p nu, the symmetric tensor. So it'd have to have some redundancy on something like that. I'd have to make sure that if I did that, I got the same answer. Now, let me actually give you a sketch of the argument for why it is that even without talking in great detail about what the interactions are, what the Lagrangian is, or whatever it is, I want to give you a sketch of an argument that goes back to Weinberg from the 60s, why these principles immediately tell us that the interaction of a single spin 1 particle, which you might call the photon, has got to be the usual one, and that gravity has to and that spin 2 particles have to satisfy the equivalence principle. Okay, so we can see this quite rapidly. And the idea is the following. Imagine you have, they're called soft photon and soft graviton theorems. Okay? Imagine, and this is something that I can describe with just a minimal amount of telling you about something about Feynman diagrams. So it's not going to be fully self-contained, but you will get the point. Okay. Imagine you have the interaction of a whole bunch of particles. It doesn't matter what they are exactly. So there is some amplitude for that interaction to take place, right? What we're interested in is to figure out the amplitude for that interaction to take place and also emit a single photon. So we want to talk about a new interaction, which is these same guys, but also with a single photon as well. Okay? Single spin 1 particle. The catch is that we're interested only in figuring out what the amplitude is when the momentum of this photon is very small. So if this photon has a momentum q, I'm interested in what happens as q goes to 0. Right? Now, if this is attached to a particle I here, if the momentum of this particle I coming out of the end was pi, then the momentum it has in here was pi plus q. Okay, so that's pi plus q and emits this photon and it goes out with momentum pi. Now, you can see that clearly the amplitude for this process is the same as what it was without attaching the photon. And now all I have to do is add the effect that this particle propagated from here to there and then emitted the photon and then turned into its last, its final asymptotic state. Okay? So whatever this amplitude is, the amplitude for n particles plus 1 photon is equal to, well, from this leg, it's the amplitude for n particles multiplied by 2 factors. One factor is the fact that it propagated, and the other factor is that it had an interaction with the photon. Okay? So let's first take care of the interaction with the photon part. Because what we're actually interested in, so that would ultimately be dotting into the polarization vector of the photon, whatever it is. Okay? So it would have to have a factor of the polarization vector of the photon. And now we want to imagine that it just has the biggest possible interaction it can have with the photon, right? So let's write down what the leading possible coupling could be between this guy and the photon. The leading possible thing it could be, because q is small, it can't have a q in there, so what I should stick in there is a p. Okay? Let me just stick a p in here. That's the biggest thing it could be. And let's say the coefficient of this, let's call it EI. Okay? I call it EI because this interaction is... this kind of interaction, this big interaction with the external momentum, is exactly what would give you an inverse square law force with charge E1 and E2 between a pair of these particles. You could have other interactions which would have the Qs in them, and those would be dipole interactions, quadrupole interactions, but the things that's just the actual inverse square law, long distance force law associated with the massless particle, is an E dot P, is an epsilon dot PI. All right. Now, what could this propagation possibly be? Well, so that's the place I could explain this in a little bit more detail. But free propagation is associated in momentum space with a factor 1 over p squared minus m squared. This has a momentum p. It would be a so-called Feynman propagator that goes like 1 over p squared minus m squared. I could actually motivate that a little bit. If you look at this in the non-relativistic limit, it will be 1 over q squared, or 1 over p vector squared. The Fourier transform of 1 over p vector squared in position space is 1 over r. So this is exactly what would give you, you see, this is exactly what would give you the standard 1 over r potentials that we are familiar with in the non-relativistic limit. But anyway, so this is the only thing you have to take on faith, okay? Well, you'll learn that in your courses soon enough. But that means here, if this particle had mass mi, whatever it is, then I have pi plus q squared minus mi squared. And now I can expand this out very easily. So this is mn. Oh, so that's what it is from this one leg. Then I'd have to sum over all the places where this photon could have come off. Okay, can sum over all the possible places the photon could have come up. So this is mn times this interesting universal factor, which is the sum of epsilon mu. This is epsilon mu associated with this momentum q dot pi mu ei over. Now what do we have here? We have p squared plus 2pq plus q squared. Q squared is equal to 0 because this is a photon. P squared is equal to m squared, right? Because that's the final particle. The p was the final momentum coming out. So this is just 2pi dot q. So with essentially no work, not talking in any too much detail about what the whole Lagrangian and everything is, talking about the leading possible interaction that we could be having here, we find that the amplitude for emitting a single extra particle, soft photon, is very simply related to the original one by that simple factor. Okay? All right, so now this gives us a good opportunity to check what we said, and also to see that that it has teeth. I told you that it wasn't trivial. It wasn't trivial to ensure that if you choose two different polarization vectors related to each other by shifting with the momentum of the particle, that you'd get the same answer. So let's actually see. What would it take for that to be invariant under shifting epsilon goes to epsilon plus anything proportional to q? Okay? So invariance under epsilon mu goes to epsilon mu plus anything times q mu demands that if I replace that epsilon there by a q, that sum should vanish. This demands that the sum over I of q mu pi mu over 2 q dot p ei is equal to 0. Well, q dot p cancels q dot p. So this is that a half times the sum of all the charges has got to equal 0. We just discovered charge conservation. We didn't say anything here. We just said this is some massless spin 1 particle. It's doing what it's doing. It's interacting with some particles. And we see that the only possible way that this could be Lorentz invariant is if all the charges, the only possible way it can be Lorentz invariant is for a charge to be conserved in this process. Okay. So that already, I mean, I could have taken a Lagrangian with some particle of spin 10 and root 2. They could never conserve charge, possibly. I could have coupled them with each other with an A mu. I could have done all this stuff. It all looks awesome. It cannot possibly work. And it just tells me that it cannot possibly work without much more detailed work. Okay? Yes?
EIs correspond to the charge.
So that's what I said a second ago. That's the biggest possible interaction you can have between this particle and light, and at low momentum for the spin 1 particle. This is the leading interaction you can possibly have. Anything more would be smaller because it would have powers of q in it. You can have p or q, and q is small, right? So now, q small means long distance. So this means it's the leading long distance effect that you can have for the interaction between some particle and the spin one field. That's what we call the charge, the monopole, right? The piece that goes like 1/r² in the force at long distances. All the other stuff would be dipoles, would be smaller and smaller things. We're not saying anything about that. But we're saying if it's going to carry what you would call charge, then the charge has to be conserved. Okay? Yes?
Do you get any conservation things for dipoles and higher?
Nope. No. All right. But actually, all of those things are irrelevant interactions. You know, a dipole, the strength of a dipole depends on the length scale, you know, how tiny the dipole is. So the only things that are marginal interactions are these monopole things, like charge. All right. Now, let's keep this up and derive the principle of equivalence. Okay. So let's repeat exactly the same exercise for gravity. Now, everything is the same here. What changes up here? So let's go back and just figure out what the analog is over here. We have mn again multiplied by the sum over I. Now it's the polarization vector which has an epsilon mu nu. So for a spin 2 particle, we'd have an epsilon mu nu. That's fine. There's an epsilon mu nu of q. Now what's the biggest interaction you can have here? Just two p's, pi mu, pi nu. Nothing else, right? Everything else would be smaller. So once again, we write plus pi mu, pi nu. Once again, Once again, there's some coupling in front of this whole thing. Let me call it ki for fun, kappa I. And there's an over, in the end, it's going to be the same, 2pi dot q. So this is what it is for spin 2. Now I have to have invariance under epsilon mu nu goes to epsilon mu nu plus alpha p mu, alpha nu p mu plus alpha mu p nu. But that means actually something very strong, because this alpha can be any vector that I want. It must be that if I just take, it must be that the sum over I, ki, and if I replace that epsilon mu nu, if I just take one of the indices and I replace it by its q, then I would get q dot pi, but I leave the other index free, pi mu, let's say, over 2 q dot pi has got to equal 0. Okay. Really, if I did it, I'd get q dot pi, p dot alpha has got to equal 0, but alpha can be anything I want, so this had better be a statement for every individual component of that vector. All right? So this is an interesting statement. This is a statement that the sum over I of ki pi mu is equal to 0. Now, we know whatever's going on here, that momentum is certainly conserved. Energy momentum is conserved. So the conservation of energy momentum tells you already that the sum of p mu itself is equal to 0. Now you have a problem, because if the k's are just generic things, then the momentum conservation is constraining the sum of the momenta to add up to 0. This would be constraining some other linear combination of the sum of the momenta add up to 0. And that would mean that the scattering can only take place at certain specific angles. Okay? You can't put more than one constraint. You know, for generic momenta coming in, we have generic momenta coming in, generic momenta coming out. That would be impossible to satisfy with both of these constraints. Imposing this constraint, if the k's are just totally random things, would force the angle, would force the scattering to depend in some crazy way, non-smoothly. It would say it can only scatter in that angle, or at that angle, or at that angle. Okay, that's completely unphysical. So, what can we do? There's only one solution to this, which is that if all the ki's are equal to each other. So if all ki's are equal, if all of these ki's are equal, then this is automatically satisfied by momentum conservation. But we just learned something. We learned that every single particle in nature must have the same strength coupling to this massless spin 2 particle. And that's the principle of equivalence, the universality of the interaction of gravity. Okay? So I hope you see, even if you didn't understand the details, the gist of how incredibly constraining it is to make these things satisfied. And immediately, for a photon, we got charge conservation. For spin 2, we get the principle of equivalence, just as a consequence of these basic, basic requirements of putting together quantum mechanics, relativity, and locality. Okay? Now, we also learned something interesting. What about massless spin 3 particles? Can we have massless spin 3 particles, giving rise to inverse square law forces? If we did the same thing with massless spin 3, what would be the equation we would find? Massless spin 3, we would have to have that the sum over I, ki, pi mu, pi nu is equal to 0. One more p. You see, we went from the sum of what I called before, ei is equal to 0, then the sum of ei, pi equals 0, what I called ki. Now we have to go to this for massless spin 3. Well, that's just dead impossible. Okay? Now there's nothing you can do. That really does put an extra kinematic constraint on the particles coming out. That's why we don't see inverse square law forces associated with massless spin 3 particles, spin 17 particles, nothing. Okay? So we're winnowing down drastically what might occur that we can describe in this language of local quantum mechanics and relativity put together. The only possible massless, ignoring the masses of all the particles, which we want to do in the approximation we're interested in, we can have massless spin 0, spin 1/2, and spin 1. The spin 1 interactions are clearly quite constrained. Let me just say a few more things about it, and then we'll stop. But I just want to finish the sort of punchline, or the summary. Let's go back to spin 1 for a second, and just so you see, so we did this in a particular example, talking about a particular process, and saw that it was possible to arrange some of the interactions, the charges, so that at least this minimal thing was satisfied. Okay? But let's say you really want to build the whole interaction, all the interactions, the whole interaction Hamiltonian, or the interaction Lagrangian, right? You want to, I mean, this sounds pretty tough. There needs to be some guiding principle that tells you how to go about doing it. A clue to this guiding principle is the following. Notice that we're trying to ensure that epsilon mu and epsilon mu plus p mu times anything, let me write that anything now as lambda, are the same. We're trying to ensure that these correspond to the same state. It would be very nice, then, if in our interaction Hamiltonian, somehow, the analog of this statement in position space was true. Now, what is the analog of the statement in position space? In position space, this would be something like A mu. This is A mu And what is the derivative? What is the p mu? It's a derivative. Okay. So we somehow have to arrange it so the Lagrangian treats a mu and a mu plus d mu lambda the same. It should be invariant under what looks like, to those of you who know, a gauge transformation. Okay. But gauge symmetry isn't here because we have a global symmetry and we want to make it local because it's so nice. And then all of a sudden we do all these things and we talk about fiber bundles and poof, we're talking about the interactions. That's complete crap. Complete, utter crap. Okay. In fact, there's zero content, absolutely zero content to gauge symmetry. It's not a symmetry. Just like you see up here, it's really a redundancy. It's we're trying to give the theory breathing room to describe it the way we like. It needs some elbow room. But the elbow room is all in our head. We're giving this elbow room and then demanding that we undo the problems that we caused by having these things be thought of as the same, by identifying them. Ordinary symmetries aren't like that. Ordinary symmetries take two actually different configurations and they map them to each other. Ordinary symmetries, global symmetries, have teeth. Ordinary global symmetries have consequences. You know, they tell you that different energy levels in the harmonic in the hydrogen atom are the same because they're related to each other by some symmetry. These are not like that at all. There's nothing conserved associated with them. They don't do anything. They're a redundancy. They are the only way we know of to describe this physics in a local way by adding lots of degrees of freedom that are not there and then doing our damnedest to make sure that all the degrees of freedom become identified with each other, physically identified with each other. But nonetheless, to get going, a zeroth order thing you should expect to see in the Lagrangian is some kind of invariance under a transformation that looks like that. Similarly, for gravity, you would call it an h mu nu, and the h mu nu should have an invariance under something that looks like this. And if you've done a little bit of GR in linearizing around flat space, this is what the diffeomorphisms look like. Okay, so diffeomorphisms are also a redundancy. They're also in our head. They're also just a way of describing this physics in the language that we like in a local way. But you should also start seeing something like that at the level of the interaction Lagrangian. Now, that's just for things like, going back to spin one, that's just for things like photons. And in fact, if you're a little bit, if you go and study QED, you'll find that, well, even if you don't study QED, if you're putting in these stick figure interactions between the spin one and the, let's say, other particles. So this is my spin one particle, other particles. And we call this interaction E. Then, okay, if it's just a single spin one particle, you have something like that. You would also draw by Bose statistics a picture like that. And you would add them up. And then you'd go and check. You'd want to check whether it's true that if you replace epsilon by epsilon plus anything times P, that you get the same answer. So now this is a slightly more sophisticated version of our Weinberg argument. We're not just doing it for soft particles anymore. We're really trying to check it for a more generic process. If you do that, you find here that it actually works beautifully. That if you just had this diagram, in fact, it wouldn't work, and this diagram, it wouldn't work. But in the sum of the two of them, the amount you're off by cancels exactly, and so this is indeed something which is good. Okay, and it doesn't. You can put any E here that you want, and everything works out fine. Now, I mention that because you might then imagine having several species of particle here. Let's say you have a particle I and J. So I'll label these particles with some index I and J that runs from 1 to the number of these particles. And so number of little kinds of particles. And you might also imagine you have many kinds of spin 1 particles, which I'll label by A, the 1 up to, so this is, and matter, okay, and this A goes to some other N, M, doesn't matter. Okay? So you might imagine having several species of these particles and several species of those particles. Then what you would call that interaction, whatever else it is, it should know about A and I and J. So let's say it's proportional to TA or JA, I'm using JAIJ. I'm just calling that interaction JA, let me call it TA. I have too many J's, okay? Okay, so now if we were to draw the analog of these diagrams, we'd have an I here, maybe a K there, and a J there. An I here, a K there, and a J there. We'd have an A and a B, an A and a B. So whatever else is going on, everything should be exactly the same as in this just single massless spin one particle case, because I didn't change anything else other than adding just labels for all the external particles. But the first diagram would be proportional to TA, IK, over here. And then this one would be TB, KJ. The second diagram would be proportional to the other way around, TB, IK, TA, KJ. Now, I told you that when it was all massless spin 1, there was a cancellation between these two diagrams. So when you add them up, there's a relative minus sign. Okay? And they gave 0 before. Now when you add them up, okay, so there's one minus the other. All right. Well, if you just look at this, if you think about TA and TB as both being little n by n matrices, this is just the commutator of TA and TB, the IJ element of it. So if these T's were totally random, I can't do it. It was fine before. The shifting the polarization vector canceled before. It doesn't cancel anymore if these T's don't commute with each other. So you could give up, or you could notice that you could actually introduce another interaction. You could introduce an interaction between three of these A's. Let me give that interaction its own name, FABC. That's just that guy's interaction strength. And now there's a third diagram that I could talk about that I couldn't talk about just for the single spin one particle, which would look like this, I and J, A and B. So there's a third possibility that I could add here. What would this be proportional to? This would be proportional to FAB, that could be C. That would be proportional to FABC times this TC, IJ. So the only way out is if it's possible to introduce these sorts of interactions and arrange the TA and the TB to satisfy that funny identity. That's why the most general interactions of massless spin one particles are given by Yang-Mills theory. That's the Lie algebra that we talked about for any Lie group. And these are precisely the interactions of Yang-Mills theory. So if you want to talk about multiple spin one particles, then there's no way of doing it other than having them associated with the Yang-Mills theory. We see the whole Lie algebra structure, all of this group theory, all this beautiful math is just being forced on us by broken record. Quantum mechanics, relativity, follow it to its bitter end, describe it in a local way. You just can't do it any other way. We have to bake in all of this remarkable structure, because it's trying to do something very remarkable. I mean, it's really striking that there's so much tension here between putting quantum mechanics, relativity, masslessness, locality together. It's an extremely rigid structure, and we have to make it extremely special in order to make it all consistent. Okay. Now, can we have multiple spin two particles? No. Just a generalization of these arguments tell you that it's impossible. There can be only one kind of massless spin 2 particle, and its interactions are universal. And we just decided that starting at spin 3 and higher, there's just nothing we can even talk about that would give us any reasonable interactions at low energies. So we've concluded that no matter what the heck is going on to the Planck scale, there are the ideas of space-time breakdown, blah, blah, blah. But as long as the notion of local space-time makes sense and locality makes sense, at sufficiently low energies compared to the Planck scale, the theory that describes the world must consist of, it could have parts that are so weakly interacting that we would never care, we'll never know about it. So those parts, it's a very good reason no one has noticed them, even if they're there. Putting aside those parts, the part of the theory that has any reasonable interactions amongst itself can only consist of spin zero, spin a half, and spin one particles described by Yang-Mills theory in general. That's it for marginal interactions. Massless spin two is special, even though its interactions are irrelevant. The coupling is G Newton, it's irrelevant. Its interactions are also dead nailed. They're unique, they're universal. And that's the only reason we notice it. It's universal, so it adds up for everything, and at sufficiently long distances, it dominates. Okay, when everything else cancels out. But this very basic structure of the world we see around us, and that was the point of giving you this very, very lightning tour, and I'm sure there's many things that you don't understand in detail, but I wanted to get a flavor of it, of how shockingly constraining it is. Okay, that these basic principles basically dictate exactly what the world has got to look like. And that's basically also what we see. So, now, the remaining set of questions that have to be understood is, at some level, what precise sort of theory are we talking about that describes our world? There's a few other puzzles associated with it, some of which I talked about. Those fine-tuning problems are still puzzles associated with this basic picture of the world that we've got to come to some terms with. There's one last wonderful idea, which is there in this class of possible interactions is the wonderful idea of supersymmetry that can go a long way to addressing some of the other problems. So that's one class of questions. And the other class of questions has to do with moving one step beyond and figuring out what replaces the ideas of locality and what we'd have to do in situations where this whole description is just inappropriate. But as you can see, our intellectual ancestors have done a lot of legwork for us. And have really put us in a very good position. So we know what are the actually important questions and what are just solved. Okay? The basic zeroth order features of the world around us is a solved problem, which is a really remarkable thing. This would have stunned Newton. Okay? It would have stunned Maxwell. But there's essentially no choice in the way the world looks. Okay, thanks a lot.